We have people that are already jumping on in. I'm going to be sharing this on my various social media platforms. I'd love to encourage those of you who are on a social platform, please do the same. You can do that by tapping on the three buttons up at the top right-hand side of your screen, because this is going to be a fantastic conversation with our senior scholar, Professor Jason Hill, on Ayn Rand and sex. And Jason, I was looking at the Slate article, which is originally how you came across my radar. And as I mentioned, every time I go back and read it, I get something new. I'm going to pin that to this chat as well. And you talk in there a bit about your own personal journey and your sexuality and what objectivism or what Ayn Rand kind of gave to you in that regard. But I'm going to let you just take it from the top, tell us about the topic, and we're all very eager to listen and ask
Okay.
questions.
Oh, great. Okay. So that part, I'm going to talk about Ayn Rand's views on homosexuality in part two of the conversation. What I want to talk about today, and I want to leave a lot of room for discussion, so I'm going to be as brief as I can, is I've been rereading The Fountainhead because I hope to teach a course that I've taught many, many times called The Philosophic Novel. And of course, I always include Dostoevsky, Rand, portions of Victor Hugo, Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea and No Exit. So I'm rereading The Fountainhead, and I'm also rereading various parts of For the New Intellectual, and I'm reading the speech between Francisco Dencona and Hank Reardon on the meaning of sex. And it seemed to me that as I was thinking about Rand's view of sex, it occurred to me, does she have a, is there an objectivist philosophy of sex? There seems to be a contradiction or some tension between Rand's depiction of sex and then her theoretical account, or that is the sort of normative account of sex that is offered in that pithy speech, or monologue, really, that Francisco delivers to Hank Reardon as a way of sort of, I think they're both in love with the same woman, but neither of them is aware of it. And so I think I'm going to be a little bit critical here because what I'm going to say is that as we go through the depictions of sex among the various characters in The Fountainhead, particularly Howard Roark and Dominique Rankin, less so in Atlas Shrugged, and we look at Rand's depiction of sex, and then we look at her theoretical account in that speech, that monologue, that I think Rand, what I'm going to argue for is that Rand equivocates implicitly on the themes of physical sexual attraction, choice of a mate, and love. And she in that very short speech, she conflates those three registers and use them almost interchangeably. And I would like to say that they're very, very different phenomena. That is sexual attraction, choice of mate, and the emotion of love are parallel narratives, are separate narratives that can stand on their own. But she sort of treats them as indistinguishable. So what I want to say is that she commits a series of equivocations, non sequiturs, that the theory is contradictory against the backdrop of how her characters actually behave sexually. And her notion that, what we find sexually attractive in a person, or tell me what a man finds sexually attractive in a person, and I can tell you something about his philosophy of life. I want to say precedes knowledge of the other's values, convictions, principles, and even their and even knowledge of their moral character. So where do I start? Well, I want to start with that speech because it seems like a highly rationalistic account of how we ought to behave sexually. But when we look at the sex scenes between Dominic and Howard Roark, that's not how actually her characters behave. So her characters seem to contradict, in a blatant manner, the theoretical, or normative, theory of her philosophy of sex. If we can claim that there is an objectivist philosophy of sex, or the meaning of sex, rather. So, I will just read a couple passages that I find problematic and say why I find them problematic against the backdrop of Dominic and Howard Roark's sexual encounter. She says that a man's sexual choice, this is an Atlas Shrugged, is a result and the sum of his fundamental convictions. She said, a man will always be attracted to the woman who reflects his deepest vision of himself, the woman whose surrender permits him to experience or to fake a sense of self-esteem. Then she says, that a desire that is devoid of love is as contemptible. Only the man who extols the purity of a love devoid of desire is capable of the depravity of a desire devoid of love. So it seems as if we are going to be depraved creatures if we have a desire for someone, we're sexually attracted to someone, if it's devoid of love. And love is a response, as she says, to one's highest values that are expressed, it's very Aristotelian, in the person of another. So I'm just not sure that desire works that way. I think that we desire before we love. That is, we come upon a person, be it in a train station, on an airplane, in a movie theater, in the grocery store, and we sort of feel as a sexual attraction to that person. We feel an erotic pull to that person. We don't know anything about that person's convictions. We don't know anything about that person's values. A sense of life notion is very, very vague, just like how emotions are not tools of cognition. I would argue that a sense of life is a very vague way of appraising the moral worth of someone. I mean, there's a communist, a Christian, or a mystic can exhibit a sense of life, exude a sense of life that is performative, and one can be mistaken in one's assessment of a sense of life. So it seems like we come upon people in the world, we desire them, we feel a sexual attraction to them, the person who sits beside us on an airplane. We feel a pull towards them. And there is no sense of love, of course. So we desire before we love, and before we come upon an emotion such as love, which is a response to one's highest value. And I would say also that she says that there's no conflict between the standards of a man's mind and the desires of his body. That's clearly not the way that Dominique Franklin behaves in The Fountainhead, which I'll get to in a moment. But so there's no conflict between the standards of one's mind and the desires of one's body. Now, I think that this is a little bit off psychologically in the sense that we seem to desire people before we have, again, any knowledge of their convictions, of their fundamental principles, of their values. Now, whether we choose to act on that desire and whether we choose to form a long-term relationship, those are completely different issues. But the mere desiring of another person's body, I would argue, stands independently of any knowledge of their values, of their convictions. That it is that desire precedes love, and desire precedes knowledge, epistemic knowledge of a person's convictions or values. But Rand seems to, in The Fountain, in Atlas Shrugged, seems to want to have a sort of linear connection between desires and a concomitant response that follows from a preceding set of convictions that we somehow must know about the person for that desire to have any kind of moral worth, or else we're depraved. That is, if we desire someone, just mindlessly or without knowing anything about their convictions, then, to use her own words, A desire that is devoid of love is a depravity. So I'm not sure. I think there's some kind of Platonism, there's some Platonic dimension entering here. That is, it is through, very often through sex with another person, that we come to love that person. I mean, sex is part of one of many components that factor in to how we fall in love with a person. That is, just mere knowledge of a person's desires, I'm sorry, of their convictions or their values, I would argue might be necessary, but it's certainly not a sufficient condition for falling in love. If that were the case, every single objectivist would be in love with every other objectivist, since they all hold the same fundamental values, sense of life, convictions, and principles. And that's clearly not the case. So there must be something else at work aside from a response to values. And it seems to me that sex cut off from one's code of values, she argues, or she states, she doesn't give an argument, she states, is fraudulent, right? Sex cut off from one's code of values. But the way her characters, and I'm going to read some passages, one passage from The Fountainhead, that seems to contradict everything that she says in Act of the Shrug. Unless we are going to, I don't know how we can be attracted to someone. It seems like she wants to have it both ways. We have to, the attraction has to stem from a fundamental knowledge of that person's convictions and that person's values. But I'm not sure that any one of us who are adults who have been involved in sexual relationships would agree that when we come upon people whom we find sexually attractive, that we know anything about their values, about their convictions. We feel an erotic pull again. And then later on, if we choose to act on it, we can sort of discover what that person's values are. But the initial attraction that she talks about, tell me what a man finds sexually attractive, and I will tell you his entire philosophy of life, sounds a little bit preposterous and both physically untenable and psychologically undesirable. So the idea somehow that convictions translate into sexuality is very, very problematic, because I would think that in the empirical world, people as we find them exist on the order of what charges us erotically, so very often lies outside the realm of pure values, convictions, and purpose and principles. There's some carnal, primal physicality. And we see that in Dominique's appraisal of Rourke. When Dominique first comes upon Rourke, she notices his hands, she notices the hardness of his body, his muscles. It seems like pure, unadulterated lust. She doesn't know, all she knows is that he's a red-headed hoodlum, that when she later on says, "I've been raped," which I'm going to read, "I've been raped by a red-headed hoodlum who works in a quarry." Up to that point, Dominic knows nothing about Howard Rourke's values, about his principles, and Rand is certainly not an intuitionist, and she's not an intrinsicist. So there's no way that just by, a lock of red hair over his eye and the steeliness of his body and his arrogance, that she could deduce from that any of his values or any of his principles or any of his convictions. So I'm going to read one or two passages from, as I'm rereading The Fountainhead, from Dominic's assessment of her situation. After the sexual act occurs, Dominic says, "I've been raped. I've been raped by some red-headed hoodlum from a stone quarry. I, Dominic Franken, through the fierce sense of humiliation." The words gave her the same kind of pleasure she had felt in his arms. During the sex act, he threw her on the bed, just on page 220. He had thrown her down on the bed, and she felt the blood beating in her throat, in her eyes, the hatred, the helpless terror in her body. She felt his hands moving over her body, the hands that broke granite. She fought in a last convulsion. Then the sudden pain shot up through her body to her throat, and she screamed. Then she lay still. It was an act that could be performed in tenderness as a seal of love, or in contempt as a symbol of humiliation, conquest. It could be the act of a lover or the act of a soldier violating an enemy woman. He did it as an act of scorn, not as love, but as defilement. And this made her lie and submit. One gesture of tenderness from him, and she would have remained cold, untouched by the thing done to her body. But the act of a master taking shameful, contemptuous possession of her was a kind of rapture she had wanted. So it seems that Ayn Rand is very, very correct in describing precisely how sex functions among and between individuals. That is, what Dominic feels from the very first moment when she spots him in the quarry. They don't exchange any words. She feels this erotic pull to him. There's a primal carnal attraction between the both of them that precedes any knowledge of moral character, values, to say nothing of love or response to one's values. That in the fountainhead, and specifically in that scene between Atlas Shrugged, between Dominic and Rourke, that's how people psychologically can, I don't say should, but often do relate to each other. There's a lot of sadomasochistic rough sex going on. Dominic obviously has a penchant for rough sex. There's a lot of biting and drawing of blood. Rourke has very psychopathic tendencies, I think, afterwards. He just gets up and he leaves her and walks away. He doesn't come back to visit her when he goes to the Enright for the Enright project. She's just a mere afterthought in some sense. I think retrospectively, Rand sort of had to clean up the messiness of sex that I think is psychologically depicted in a realistic manner in The Fountainhead by giving us this very highly rationalistic but implausible notion of how sex ought to function in human beings, which again I find psychologically, empirically untenable, physically untenable, and psychologically undesirable. His body in Atlas Shrugged, in the speech between D'Ancona and Hank Reardon, she says, his body will always follow the ultimate logic of his deepest convictions, right? I don't think that sexual desire, simpliciter, has anything to do with convictions. So here I think Rand is again trying to create an interlocking comprehensive system where epistemology, metaphysics, ethics are neatly tied up together in a human psyche, and that there is an inexorability that follows the logic of her theory of sexuality, that from the, if you bind to the first premise, that from that is from sexual attraction is dependent on a response to a person's fundamental convictions, then deductively, the whole thing makes sense. I think what I would like to do is reject the first premise that sexual attraction has nothing to do with convictions, with values. That is what we find when we come upon someone that we find sexually attracted. We know nothing about them. We just feel this erotic charge. We don't know anything about their values, their convictions. It is true that the attraction could heighten and intensify as a result of getting to know their values. But the initial attraction, the initial chemistry, to use contemporary language, that people feel between themselves seem to be devoid of any kind of knowledge of one's convictions or one's values. And the other thing I wanted to, and I'll stop here because I want to... I've been going on for 20 minutes, and I want to stop at exactly 20 minutes. The other thing that I want to question is, it's not only that we desire before we love, and that is, you know, and that, but I question the idea whether love is a response to one's highest values. I mean, I've also been reading, I'm a big fan of Esther Perel's Mating in Captivity and some of her other works, and I don't necessarily agree with everything she says, but she's very insightful in pointing out that it is through sex, again, that we come to love other people. It is through sex that we learn the body language, the emotional language, and the sex language of the other. So the idea somehow that sex, that love is a response to values, seems a little strange to me because it is through sex that sex has epistemic value, I want to say. That it is through sex that we come to understand and know the layeredness of another person, the multifacetedness of another person. It is not just access to their values and their convictions, as we find happening between Dagny and John Galt, that concomitantly, once we find out these things, that we share common values, we share a sense of life, then, we fall in love. I think people quite often seem to be drawn to the extremes in others that they themselves lack. So there's more of the Fountainhead that I could have read, but I really think that the depiction in the Fountainhead, between the sex scene between Dominic and Howard Roark, represents psychologically how we function as sexual beings, rather than this kind of convoluted speech that has a lot of there's a lot of equivocation going on. There are a lot of non sequiturs. The conflation between, or among, I should say, sexual attraction, a choice of a mate, and love. Rand treats all of these as if they're interchangeable, and they most certainly are not. And again, the idea that there's no conflict between the standards of one's mind and the desires of one's body seems to me very, very fallacious. No conflict between the standards of your mind and the desires of your body. Well, the desires of your body precede any knowledge of what you know about the person to whom you're attracted. I think there are very, very few people who walk up to someone at a bar and says, "Tell me your premises. Tell me your fundamental principles. What do you think of man? What do you think of capitalism?" And then on hearing this, they fall in love. No, we see people and we're inexperienced. For some reason, we're drawn to them. For a multiplicity of reasons, we're drawn to them sexually. And we find that knowledge of their values or their principles can either enhance our attraction, or in some sense, it can bore us to death because we might be looking for not values that are inimical to our own, but some sense of tension between what another the values of another person and the values that we hold, a reasonable tension that can spark and ignite eroticism. So I just think psychologically, this notion of values and convictions being tied to eroticism is a rationalistic construct that has really no bearing on how people function psychologically or erotically. I have so much more to say, but I'm sure that what I have to say will probably come out in a question and answer a session that I hope will follow. Thank you. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Jason. Well, I was not expecting that, but I love it. This is the Atlas Society, so everyone here is welcome to. We're not going to be serving up just a dogmatic regurgitation of Ayn Rand's ideas. We do occasionally question and debate them, but we also have the founder of that organization, Professor David Kelly. And David, I know you've thought about this subject. I don't know if you have any reaction to Jason's observations. You'd have to. There you go.
Thank you, Jennifer and Jason. I have so much to say, or it is Jason's presentation launched so many thoughts that I don't know, almost don't know where to start. But I'll keep it limited. First of all, I think I will say, as a philosopher, that the sexual ethics of objectivism, or Ayn Rand's sexual ethics, are the weakest part of the whole philosophy. And for some of the reasons that Jason mentioned, I think there is an equivocation, or at least we should avoid an easy equivocation between physical attraction, relationships, and mate, and love. There are, I mean, in my experience and experience of most of the people I know, there are different factors that go into all those things. And there's a huge body of research on this by Helen Fisher, who's many of us know from her our contacts with her, and by many other psychologists. So, I think this is one area where philosophy intersects with psychology, and Ayn Rand's psychological theses are definitely need to be questioned and not considered the essence of the philosophy in pertaining to relationships. It has to do with practicing honesty, self-esteem, and the basic values. But how you apply those in a romantic relationship involves a lot of psychology and personal variation. But one thing I want to say about The Fountainhead, too, is that about Rourke and Dominique, that scene, their first sexual encounter, the rape scene, so-called, is fascinating for the reasons that Jason mentioned. One thing, though, I would add to that, it's not Dominique didn't know anything about Rourke's character or values. He didn't know anything about her values or character. Well, in a sense, I think they did, at least on Rand's conception, because she had this idea that you could see a lot of a person in their face. There's a scene later at a party where Dominique is talking with Ellsworth Toohey, and he says, you don't think you can tell a lot by face? Well, you can. And Rand overestimated what we can tell. I think what she intended here was that Rourke could see that Dominique was attracted to him but resisted it, and he somehow intuited her basic issue of being afraid of valuing anything. And so that's why he acted as he did. Now, you could question that assumption on Rand's part, but I think there's more, there is a little bit more to it than simply, she was hot for him and he was hot for her. So I'll leave it there.
Yes, we won't add any spoilers, though I'm tempted to, in terms of The Fountainhead, because the relationship changes over the course of the novel, and in that scene, Dominique is at kind of the beginning of her character arc, and she changes quite a bit. That's part of the drama of the novel. All right, Scott.
Thank you. I hope I'm not skipping Eric. Great topic. We actually talked about this a little bit, Professor Hill. So I'm generally in agreement. I think that, as a writer, she was writing about these stylized ideals, and that to some extent that's what that scene in Atlas Shrugged was, that there is a biological aspect. And I was just going to share two quick anecdotes that show that, she may not have even had that attitude in real life, because one, I heard a story of her not wanting to get her cats neutered to deny them that pleasure. And then the other one was Brandon telling a story of Peikoff coming to Rand and talking about a new girl. And she asked him something like, is this something of a long-term relationship? Is it, something casual, or is it just like a one-night stand? Something, three choices. And he said that, Leonard's jaw dropped to the floor, because, he didn't even realize those others were possibilities, that it couldn't be anything but, a highest reflection of your values. So I think it's possible that maybe, she didn't even mean for it to be that, that, except when it benefited her, maybe. Thank you.
Jason.
Well, I mean, these are anecdotal stories, and, we have to take the written part of what's in the Atlas Shrugged as definitive statements of Rand. So I want to respond to David's assertion that Rand thought that you could learn a lot by the reading of the face. I would reject that explicitly. If emotions are not tools of cognition, And facial reading certainly can't be a tool of cognition, especially among people who are really, really good actors and frauds and poseurs. And if one spends a lot of time, as I certainly have, around professional actors, you know that you can be caught in the throes of their chicanery and their narcissism. So the idea that if emotions are not tools of cognition, I really fail to see how reading something in a face is an epistemological guide to a person's values or principles or convictions. A person can convey strength, and a person can convey confidence, but these are all would be guilty of context dropping in Rand's own terms, because strength in and of itself and confidence betrays a question of, well, to what area is that strength being applied to? Is it strength in terms of exercising dominion over other people? What is one confident about? You know, is one confident about the fact that one is a Don Juan? So we have to take keep the context in question. So I'm not really buying into Rand's notion that Dominic read into Rourke's, was able to read, if this is what she was implying, that Dominic was able to read into Rourke's face the entire repertoire of his value system, his convictions, and his principles, and that she had sort of, and Rand is not an intuitionist, so, I mean, she doesn't believe, she's rejected the theory of intuitionism. So how could she intuit, if she intuits this and then she loves him? That's certainly not the language that we find in The Fountain. What we find is raw, primal, naked, brutal attraction and sadomasochistic rough sex between two characters. And there's nothing wrong with that, of course. So that's why I think that Rand's depiction of how Dominic and Howard Rourke behaved initially is more psychologically plausible and an accurate descriptor of how people actually are attracted to each other without knowing anything about the other's convictions and values, and need not be condemned to depravity, as she certainly condemns such individuals to depravity in Atlas Shrugged. But this notion of facial reading and being able to tell a lot about a person by looking at their face, if she rejects emotions as tools of cognition, I'm failing to see. I want to see a theory of gaining epistemic access to a person's values and convictions and principles through facial reading. I mean, she hasn't produced that work, and she never produced that work, and I'm actually not convinced.
If I could just reply very briefly, I don't disagree with you. I was saying Rand, to interpret The Fountainhead, you have to appreciate Rand's view about what you can read in a person. Or what her heroes can read in other people. But I think she was exaggerating that at best, and but it certainly, you know, it's not a general principle, and to whatever extent it might hold for some people, it is not explained. So I don't differ from you on that. I was just saying, if we want to interpret The Fountainhead and what's going on there, you know, giving Rand the benefit of the doubt as an artist, not a philosopher. We should interpret it accordingly. But again, philosophically, I agree with you.
All right. And thank you, Scott. I hadn't seen Eric there. Is that the birthday boy, Eric? You want to unmute yourself?
It certainly is. I have been listening into this amazing conversation.
Happy birthday, Eric.
Thank you so much.
So Eric is new to objectivism. He's actually my spin class instructor, but I, without thin slicing, without necessarily just looking at his face, but certainly listening to the kinds of words he would use to choose to try to inspire people in his class, and seeing his bearing, I did get a sense, hopefully not too much intuition, because I thought this was a guy who might get these ideas, and here he is. So, Eric, did you have a question for Professor Hill?
I really don't have a question off the top of my head. I'm just eager to continue listening and to continue my journey with objectivism.
Spectacular. Well, and I know that, Jason, we're going to be getting to the second part of this, which is Ayn Rand and her views on homosexuality and whether or not there's any kind of distinction between the ideas that you're laying out and how they might apply to same-sex relationships. But I am eager to hear whether there are differences, because I do think that in talking about sexuality, Ayn Rand had a view about love, about women and men being very different, about male worship, hero worship, but specifically male worship. So a lot more rich stuff to dive into there, but love to get to our Bigfoot in the room. I always love when Roger joins our conversations and brings his massive fan base. So, Roger.
Oh, thanks, Jennifer. This is an interesting topic, and it's something that I haven't dove too deep into Rand's thoughts around. But promiscuity, my guess is that she would find it to be against rational self-interest. And if I'm correct on that, Jason, if you could just explain, I'd love to have a great non-biblical argument prepared for the conversation of why promiscuity is not in our self-interest.
Right. Well, I think Rand lays it out quite clearly where she talks about that a man wants, a proper rational man would want a woman who reflects his deepest vision of himself, and the woman whose surrender permits him to experience a sense of self-esteem, and from a brainless slut, she says, would never be able to give him or reflect back to him his deepest vision of himself. A depraved human being is not one who would reflect, or naked ego in its singularity that stands in terms of being proud of itself, which consists of its values and its principles. So she held that sex was too good, not that it was evil, but that was too good to be promiscuously allocated among indiscriminate bodies. So, you know, she in the Duncanya speech, she says there is a man who she calls practical, the man who despises principles, abstractions, art, philosophy in his own mind. And he regards the acquisition of material objects as the only goal of existence. And he expects them to give him pleasure. And he wonders why he gets nothing from them. And she says he's the man who spends his time chasing women. So it seems like it's tied to Rand's idea that values and principles are natural corollaries, or one could say they're concomitants of desire, that there's a one-to-one correspondence between the desires that you have, and this is what I was questioning, and their relationship to the values and the principles that those desires are responding to in the body of another person. Now, one reason that promiscuity, on her reasoning, I imagine, would be impermissible would be that you'd be just spreading yourself thin among a bunch of second-handers, a bunch of mediocre people, and you're behaving more like a farm animal or a jungle beast. That is, you'd be taking a biological act and divesting it of its value orientation that is affixed to it, and that there's something that is demeaning and degrading about that, because sex is too good. Why is sex too good? Because sex is supposed to be a response to is again inextricably tied to physical attraction, to love, the choice of mate, all of which are reducible to something like not just a sense of life, but a response to one's, another person's values or convictions. So you'd be betraying the logic of your own body, which is supposed to follow inexorably from the logic of your convictions. So there'd be massive betrayal, I think, going on, Roger, because if you are promiscuous and you're just spreading yourself thin among a bunch of brainless sluts, to use her words, there's a way in which you're betraying the convictions that ought to be driving your sexual desire. If you're a person of great self-esteem, there's nothing that a brainless slut or a set of brainless sluts can give to you on the order of offering you your deepest vision of yourself. You would want, in her words, to be attracted to a heroine. That's another thing I find very, very problematic about her theory of sex. I don't know too many people in the world who, and I don't know that it's psychologically desirable to go around aspiring. One is going to be condemned to a life of loneliness. I don't know too many people who go around the world saying, unless they're pretentious 22-year-old objectivists, who go around the world thinking, I will never be satisfied with anything less than a hero or a heroine. That just seems like one is guilty of grandiosity. One can be attracted to someone who's decent, who's kind, who's benevolent, who's rational, who's guided by reason, and have all the attributes that are affiliated with objectivism without being some grand heroine or hero. So the way that Rand, I think, has set it up is that sexual exaltation is dependent on a set of corresponding values that you find in yourself, a set of values that you find in yourself that correspond in another person, and you're just not likely to find that if you spread yourself thin among 100 women, or if you're gay, 1,000 or 100 men. So you'd be debasing yourself, basically.
Thank you for that, Jason. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And we had a few more people join us in the room. I want to reiterate my request for a favor that I mentioned up at the top of the hour. If you're enjoying this conversation, we are building our community here on Clubhouse. So please do me a favor, share this conversation, tap the three dots up at the top right-hand side of your screen, let people know that you are enjoying it and invite them to join in. Peter.
Are we recording this, Jennifer? I hope we are, right?
Yes, yeah, we are. Good. Replays will be available, and we make all of our Clubhouse conversations, along with our weekly webinars, available on our podcast platforms. So, Peter, you want to unmute yourself? Or maybe we will return to you, JP.
Hi, thank you. So I would like to go to the other torrid sex saga in Atlas Shrugged between Hank and Dagny. To me, those parts of the book were not very enjoyable in the sense that I couldn't fathom in my head how such intelligent people could have such kinks. In time, Rand makes sense of it. And in time, you learn that this was their own contradictions being exposed. But is there a more What do we make of Hank and Dagny?
Well, I think the same thing that we make of Dominic and Franklin. Look, there's just, without being crass, Rand's characters have sex in a very cold, there's not a lot of tenderness. And there's a section that I read in The Fountainhead that had Howard Roark responded to Dagny with tenderness. In the initial sexual encounter, her body would have gone cold. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of the characters relate to each other sexually in very abstract, cold. Rand talks about ascetic passion. That seems to be a misplaced metaphor. I don't know that asceticism, that Roark had a sort of ascetic passion, that asceticism and passion can go together. I said that Rand's depiction of sex among her characters are plausible, they're realistic, they like hot sex, they like rough sex, they have kinks. There's nothing wrong with that. And had she left those depictions as freestanding sexual actions among her characters, that would have been fine. I think the whole thing gets spoiled when she starts to, maybe armchair quarterbacking or retrospectively trying to tidy up the messiness of the sexual activities of her characters by giving this meaning of sex that's, I read as quite normative. This is how people ought to behave sexually, because I've never met anyone who behaves sexually that way, the way Francisco describes sex to Hank Reardon. I've never met someone whose desires are dictated by their moral convictions. I mean, I would like somebody to ostensibly point out how you can desire someone sexually and that desire be based on your convictions about their, a knowledge of their convictions and knowledge of their values when you're standing in a supermarket line and you know you don't know a damn thing about them, right? So this is why I think there's a more plausible and realistic account of the sexual actions among her characters. They all do share something in common. There is a common leitmotif that runs through Rand's sexual characters. They love a lot of hard, brutal, rough, violent sex. There's a lot of blood being drawn. There's a lot of biting. There's a lot of humiliation and degradation and mixed in with hatred and there are people in the world who engage in that kind of sexual activity. I don't think it detracts morally at all from the moral stature of her characters. These are sexual acts among and between consenting adults. And although Rourke's rape of Dominic, you know, is a little, I think, questionable, but these are still consent. She didn't press charges against him. So they're still consensual acts among people. So I don't know that I would say that such intelligent people can have such kinks. Again, we run the risk of running into this sort of hyper-rationalistic idea that if you're rational and if your sexual desires proceed inexorably from your sexual convictions and your values and your principles and knowledge of the other person's values and principles, an endeavor I don't know how would be possible. Then I think this part of the lure of the readers to the sexual lives of these characters is because Rand does capture something in the sadomasochistic, erotic dimension that exists among people that people can actually relate to in the privacy of their own lives. They can recognize themselves as, yeah, I like that kind of sexual activity. I like that kind of absence of tenderness. I do like it a little on the brutal side. And so that I have no problems with. The problems I have have to do with, again, the hyper-rationalistic attempt to fix the messiness and to rationalize it. I think, you know, when David talks about, to be fair to Rand, that one could read a lot in one's face, that seems to be rationalization of something that Rand herself just couldn't sit well with. That, look, you can't make these attributions to Rand herself because I have no idea what her sex life was like or what she liked. But if she's projecting any of that onto her characters, it seems very, very unproblematic to me that people would conduct themselves in that sexual way if they're, it's not appealing to me in all respects, but, you know, I'm just a reader, but that people would enjoy these kinds of sexual acts among themselves, even though they claim to love each other. And again, I'm glad you raised this point because it points to the messiness of sex and it points to the messiness of eroticism and the idea that somehow sex follows an inexorable logic of convictions and values speaks to a paucity of knowledge about human sexuality from a deep psychological perspective that I think Rand didn't suffer from because she depicted it sexually, but she tried to overlay it with this hyper-theoretical construct in the short speech. And that's where I think for her, the sexual depictions of sex to be consistent with her epistemology, with her ethics, it had to follow this inexorable logic to make it an interlocking, comprehensive, non-contradictory system.
So in a way, it's a self-validation that she deemed necessary to illustrate her philosophy in a way.
Well, I think she just wouldn't be. I think she just would not be satisfied with looking at the pure carnality and primal lust of that her characters have for each other, especially like that first sex scene with Dominic and Rourke. From the minute she lays eyes on him, it's pure infatuation. It's not love, I don't think, because she has no access to his values. So given Rand's definition, it can't be love. It's not a response to values. It's lust. It's a primal, carnal, visceral draw to a hyper-masculine man to whom she wants to submit and be dominated by, and feel some sense of degradation and humiliation. And this all makes psychological sense sexually. People go through these fantasies. So, but I think that later on in Atlas Shrugged, for some reason, Rand just, I don't know why she couldn't be just satisfied with the depiction of sex, why we had to have this overlay of this speech, which is supposed to sort of tidy up the messiness of sex as she quite artfully illustrated it in both Atlas Shrugged between the among the characters and in The Fountainhead.
All right. Well, we are coming up at about time. So if I could just get a very quick question from you, Chrissy, and then I'll get to Lawrence, and then we will be closing it out.
Yes, thank you. Sorry. So I guess really quick question then, because I have a lot. So Jason, do you still actively teach in Chicago?
Oh, yeah. I'm a professor at DePaul University. I've been there for 22 years. Yeah.
Okay. I'll soon be moving there. That was my main question. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Chrissy. Lawrence.
Yes. Thank you. Can you hear me?
You're a little soft.
Yes, hopefully I'm coming through a bit louder now. Jason, my question to you is, because this is something that I'm entirely new to me, something I really wasn't familiar with, so it's been really interesting trying to just listen and absorb all this information. So we're mainly pulling from her literary work, and as David said, this seems to be something that is one of her weaker areas of what Ayn Rand wrote about. Was there any other sources in terms of her nonfiction work that she actually has any mention of this as well? Or I'm just curious, like, what can we do for further exploration kind of in this topic?
Well, David can help me out with this though. I know that on Living, on the Fort Hall Forum talk on Living Death, she spoke explicitly about sex and sex being too good and in this very sort of exalted way. In one of the question and answer periods to in the Fort Hall Forum, I don't remember, I need to check which, I have it written down which actual talk it was. I don't remember if it was the Moratorium on Brains or A Nation's Unity, but she was asked a question about homosexuality, and she defended she thought there should be no sodomy laws, and that among consenting adults, you know, the state had no business intervening, but she personally thought it was, to use her words, she said, I find it disgusting. And there are, at least going by the biographies, I don't know if we can, how well we can trust these, but of the Brandons, especially Barbara Brandon, that Rand thought that homosexuality was a result of mixed premises and ill-formed premises, that with the right psychoepistemology, you know, a heterosexual man, for example, could certainly become straight. Leonard Peikoff talked about this, but in her, David, maybe you can answer this, but I mean, I think I've read everything that Rand's written, except the stuff in the archives. But do you know that if in her nonfiction work. I mean, I've read The Objectivist Letter, The Objectivist Magazine, the Ayn Rand Letter. I mean, everything that she's written, I've read, but can't recall coming across anything
else. Well, I would suggest The Romantic Manifesto, because when she talks about sense of life there, that's the most developed discussion she has of sense of life, and she applies it both to art and to romance. That, to me, is the most developed presentation of what I was earlier referring to, is what you can tell about a person. And it's not just the face, but it's getting a sense of life, whether you can intuit it immediately on a first, you know, love at first sight, or whether it develops. But the individuality and irreplaceability of the value you find in one person's sense of life that corresponds to yours is, I think that's the best thing to read, Lawrence.
Thank you.
We got 3 minutes, Jennifer.
All right. Well, I think with that, then, Liberty, did you have a very quick question? At least maybe if you can state it, and we'll try to get to it in the second session if it's going to require more elaboration.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Actually, no, this one could actually be answered as a yes or no without too much reflection. Jason, I'm wondering if you believe that her writing would be different done in today's world, as opposed to the morals and the whole social construct of her time then.
Great question.
It's hard to say. I mean, when you read that scene between Rourke and Dominic, Rand was pretty radical. I mean, she was really out there. I mean, I can't put thoughts into a dead woman's mind, but I doubt it very seriously. Rand was such an original in so many ways, and so idiosyncratic in the good sense in other ways, that I think if she were alive today, given the assault on masculinity, given the way that men are being feminized in our culture, and of course given the move towards ending gender, I think she would probably, and this is just a conjecture, right, I think she would probably be even more emphatic about asserting rigid gender roles and be more emphatic in her defense of man worship, you know, not just worship of the individual, but the man, the male, what she talked about, man worship. So I think that given the way in which our culture is going, the attacks on masculinity, the feminization of young boys, that Rand probably would have been twice as radical and what we would call today a reactionary in these areas. But that's just a conjecture. So thanks for the question.
What do you teach at the bar?
I teach philosophy. I teach ethics and political philosophy. And I also teach sometimes in the comparative literature department, I teach the philosophic course called the philosophic novel, but mostly politics.
Well, yeah, ethics. I was going to get my master's degree. I wasn't sure where when I get to Chicago, but cool. I was just asking. Thanks, Jennifer. I'll shut up now.
Thank you, Chrissy. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Jason. This was a really spectacular conversation. I can't wait for part two. I want to thank everybody for joining. Thanks for sharing the room as well. And we've still not done today here at the Atlas Society. In a half an hour, one of our other senior scholars, Professor Stephen Hicks, is going to be teaching, I think, part three in his course on capitalism. You can check that out at the Atlas Society events page. And then next week, we also have quite a full schedule. Rob Trzynski is going to be back on Clubhouse on Tuesday on the problem of expertise. Wednesday, I'm going to be interviewing Peter Diamandis, who's going to be talking about technology and abundance. Of course, he was the recipient of the Atlas Society's 2020 Lifetime Achievement Award at our gala. And then on Thursday, Richard Salzman, professor at Duke, senior scholar at the Atlas Society, is going to be back on Clubhouse on distinguishing four types of equality. I hope I'm not missing anything. So fantastic. Thanks, everyone. And if I don't see you in a half an hour, I'll see you next week.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks, everybody, for joining. Thank you.
Thank you.